sitting here in limbo. But I know it won't be long. Sitting here in limbo, like a bird without a song. To roll, sitting here in limbo, got some time to search my soul. Well, they're putting up resistance, but I know that my fate will lead me on.
Jamaica's Jimmy Cliff with Sitting in Limbo. It's from his award-winning 1972 album, The Harder They Come. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. And as we speak, hundreds of thousands of people fleeing chaos are in a nightmarish legal limbo as European and Mediterranean nations are shutting down their borders. At dawn today, in fact, Hungary sealed its borders, completing work on a 100-mile fence that shuts out and shuts down a main refugee route into Central Europe. Refugees began massing instead in Istanbul, planning to enter Europe via Greece and Macedonia and the Balkan route through Bulgaria. But there is no question that all throughout Europe, the refugee shutout has begun. Hungary is not a member of the European Union, but yesterday Prime Minister Viktor Orban said that his country's people and culture are being threatened by the inflow. He swore in yesterday almost 900 border police. We are fortunate to have today as our guest Alan Kraut, professor of history at American University, an affiliate faculty member of its School of International Service, and a fellow at the Washington, D.C.-based Migration Policy Institute, to discuss what the United Nations is calling the worst refugee crisis to hit Europe since World War II. Thank you so much for being with us today, Professor Kraut.
My pleasure, Eutrice.
Well, let's start with this inevitable news that we got today. The news that, at least in the mind of the Hungarian prime minister, that this inflow of refugees essentially is a threat to the very national identity. And I imagine that he is not alone in this view. And that particular sentiment is going to fuel the response by many nations that the refugees are fleeing to. Let's start there.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. There's the perception on the part of the Hungarians, but other countries in Europe as well, that rather than an act of humanitarianism or an economic opportunity to bring talent into the country, that the refugees represent a threat to the culture, a threat to the identity of their nations, and perhaps a national security threat as well, given where the refugees originate. And so I think that this is a moment in which there's a lot at stake from the perception of all sides. And it's a very, very volatile situation.
But also, the Hungarian Prime Minister Orban, is also going to be, I guess his attitude could be typical of what is to come about the notion that the European Union really is not taking care of business here, is overwhelmed, does not have a plan, doesn't seem to have a cogent response. And of course, Hungary is not a member of the European Union, so it's taking independent action. How do we interpret the European Union's response to this refugee crisis?
I think the way to interpret the European Union's response to the refugee crisis as totally inadequate, based on a tremendous lack of preparation. The European Union was formed originally to stabilize currency, to look at labor flows, to basically make Europe one economic unit with tremendous levels of cooperation and coordination. And that's exactly what's failed. Now, I think one of the reasons it's failed is because culture got in the way. There was a failure to understand that different cultures would be challenged by a massive flow of refugees. And quite frankly, I don't think anybody in Europe really foresaw the tremendous outflow of refugees at this time. And so there was no coordinated plan that was drafted. And some of the things that were done, including the so-called Dublin regulation, which says that a migrant must establish residence in the first place they enter in Europe, all of these things have gotten in the way of a plan, a flow of refugees that can be taken care of. And so what I think we're seeing is something that's very, very regrettable from the standpoint of the European Union, just a complete failure to meet the crisis head on.
But how could it be unforeseen when, in fact, many of the European nations actually have a direct hand in creating the circumstances of this mass migration of people?
I think the European Union nations never envisioned so many folks being willing to risk life and limb to go on the road to get across seas and vast amounts of space in order to get out of the region. That's what they didn't envision. And there was no effort on the ground to establish an agreement and a plan of how this might be handled should it happen. They just thought folks would stay in place and shelter in place, if you will. And that's not what's happened.
But isn't that so typical of what colonialism and imperialism are all about? The idea that we can cause great havoc in your country, but we also have the ability and the power to contain your reaction to it and to contain your movement, leave you there in the aftermath of what we have created to suffer it through, and we have no further responsibility to you. I don't understand why this central question is not being raised and not part of the dialogue, the international dialogue on the relationship between these awful consequences of war and incited war and the mass migration of people forced to leave countries that through no fault of their own have descended into this pit of violence because in large measure other forces came into their countries and created havoc.
Especially since there's ample precedent. The last time we had a major refugee crisis was, of course, between 1975 and 79, when we had Laotians and Cambodians and Montagnards on the move. There was over 2,500,000 folks resettled, 1,200,000 in the United States, with smaller numbers going to Britain, Germany, France, and Canada. So that was one refugee crisis. The largest, of course, in living memory, was the one after the Second World War, when immediately after the war there were between 7 and 11 million persons without residence who were out of slave labor camps, concentration camps, And there were displaced persons camps, DP camps, established in various parts of Europe to handle the flow. It was a very difficult project, but in fact, by 1946, the number in the DP camps had been reduced to about 1,100,000. By 1947, 960,000, and gradually different countries taking refugees dissipated the number in the camps, and the camps could finally be closed. So it isn't as if there hasn't been haven't been refugee crises before. It's simply that the European Union preferred not to focus on the problem and not to make plans in advance that could have handled the problem adequately. And now we have a crisis.
Well, we also, I mean, in the discussion of refugees and, just wholesale genocides, we just don't hear the discussion of places like Darfur or the Biafran War, where you had literally millions of people exterminated in conflicts aided and abetted and incited by foreign governments. We just don't hear these discussions at all. So, it is very interesting that now the question of refugees and, it's coming in the context of the World War II, but we have had several instances of mass migrations of people and mass impact on people, deaths, tortures and so forth. People who have no way out of a situation that they did just not create. I want to ask then, even so, with the attitude within that's pervasive now throughout the European Union that, they've been blindsided by a humanitarian problem for which they really have no other responsibility than a moral one, how do you explain or how is it that the European Union as a whole has just decided that they will not recognize their legal obligation, the international conventions of law that or obligate them to do something far more planned, far more cogent than what is happening now?
Well, I'm not sure they feel that obligation. I mean, some of the obligation comes through the UN, and indeed the UNHCR, the UN High Commission for Refugees, has been active in trying to extend aid. But many of the European countries don't see this as their own national responsibility. And as part of the EU, the planning has simply been ineffective. I think one also has to ask, what about the countries closer to the region of crises? What are the Saudis doing? What are the Jordanians doing? Are the countries closer to Syria stepping up to the plate and doing their part for refugees? So it's a worldwide problem. It should be a regional problem. Clearly it's an EU problem now, too.
Well, but could you answer that question? What are the countries in the region doing?
I think not enough. And clearly, the situation has spun out of control because of the inability to intervene in Syria adequately and impose some sort of solution in that area. Afghanistan, Eritrea, there are many, many places that are war zones that folks are fleeing. And the arrival of ISIS on the scene has inflamed the situation even more so in parts of the Middle East. I mean, what we see is a region at war against itself. And until some sort of order is restored in the region, you're going to continue to have refugee flows. So what's happening on the refugee front is, of course, intimately connected to the politics of the region. The politics of the region right now are in a state of chaos.
But the politics of the region, I continue to maintain, the politics of the region have been shaped really outside of the region. And let's say the case of Syria, which is accounting for an inordinately high number of refugees, the United States is clearly involved here as a main adjutant to this problem. And yet the United States has said, well, okay, we'll take 10,000 Syrians, and that would be our token nod to the humanitarian effort toward refugees. But this is a big issue, it seems to me, that there ought to be an international discussion, because this has happened so often where people are forced into these dire circumstances because of the warmongering by major nations going after the assets of many of these smaller countries and basically having their way in these countries, creating absolute havoc and turmoil, and nobody seems to be able to rein them in. And yet when these things happen, they further exacerbate the problem by saying, we're not responsible. These are people, you know, we wish them luck, we wish them the best, and you know, our prayers and thoughts are with them. But beyond that, we really have no responsibility here.
Well, I think the primary responsibility rests with in Syria with Assad and the conflict that's going on in Syria. I don't think that President Obama helped the crisis very much when he came up to the red line and backed off in terms of American intervention. So I certainly would agree with that. The United States has not acted in a leadership role with respect to the Syrian crisis, and that's bore very, very bad fruit indeed. But the final analysis, the chaos in the region is being created by forces within the region. And Mr. Assad and his treatment of his people, his treatment of the Kurds, is a case in point.
All right. Do you agree or disagree that there is a direct link between major nations of the world, Britain, France, the United States, Russia, China? I mean, they all seem to have a hand in creating havoc in other people's countries, and then walking away. And then, in fact, when the inevitable consequences occur, they also wash their hands and say, well, we're not responsible. This is now, as in the case of Syria, it's Assad. In the case of Iraq, it was Saddam Hussein who was the problem. And yet we know, because our intelligence reports are telling us, that the United States and other foreign countries went into these regions with a particular plan, including the assassination of their leaders, including creating havoc in the country, including taking possession of their most valuable assets, whether it's oil or uranium or whatever the minerals are, and creating circumstances that would make life intolerable for the vast majority of people left there. In Nigeria, for example, when Britain went into what was then called British Nigeria and created the first major upheaval, post-colonial upheaval, by pitting one ethnic group against the other, resulting in the so-called Biafran War or the Nigerian War, we found that Britain just said, well, you know, look, these people can't control themselves. They can't govern themselves, as if it had no role whatsoever in creating a crisis in which hundreds of thousands of people were killed, slaughtered, and millions displaced. So the big countries, the ones with the power and the weaponry, have been given a pass all these decades, hundreds of years, for doing exactly what we're seeing now unfolding in Europe. Would you agree or disagree with that?
Well, I would say it's an overstatement. In fact, a lot of the countries that we're talking about have been independent countries for a while. Yes, it's true that the roots of colonialism go deep and were the origins of many, many problems in the world, but that doesn't speak to the moment. It doesn't speak to what's going on in those countries now, and it doesn't speak to a solution to the problem. It is a kind of vague condemnation of a bad condition. Most of us would agree that imperialism was a bad thing. Colonialism was a disaster. But that's not where we are now. And where we are now is with dictators like Assad, who are being challenged by forces within their own country, and a radical Islamic element which spreads nothing but death and hatred in the world. And that's what we have to cope with. So I'd like to see us kind of address those problems in a constructive way, but it's certainly not being done by the European Union. The UNHCR is inadequate to the refugee problem. The United States has hesitated to involve itself in the Syrian conflict, and now is sort of standing at the perimeter, urging others on with respect to helping the refugees. There are a lot of issues here that are very immediate and need to be dealt with. So as a historian, I of course appreciate the legacy of imperialism, but I don't think that at the moment that discussion is directly relevant to dealing with the situation.
From your perspective, what is a workable idea right now?
Well, a workable idea right now would be one not unlike that suggested by Peter Schuck, who's a law professor at Yale University. What Schuck suggested in an op-ed piece in the New York Times a while ago was that the European Union nations basically bargain with one another. Some are more willing to take refugees and more able to take refugees than others. Those who don't wish to or can't accept refugees, however, could compensate monetarily or in terms of commerce those nations that are willing to take refugees. In other words, use capitalism in the best sense of opening up opportunities for places where refugees can go. Because these folks have to go somewhere. They can't go back. There's nothing to go back to. And so it behooves all of those nations to deal with one another in order to solve the refugee crisis. And that at least is one way of dealing with it. Second, of course, is generosity. But generosity will only go so far. There has to be something more material at stake. And that's why I think Schuck's proposal is a good one.
Well, how about obeying the law? How about obeying the conventions that they signed, like the Schengen Agreement signed some 30 years ago that said essentially refugees reaching Europe will be granted asylum, and that the European nations signing on to the Schengen Agreement have a legal obligation to do their best to accommodate the refugees fleeing countries where life is now intolerable? How about that?
Well, the question with such agreements always is, who will enforce them? Who will step up to the plate and make the agreement real and binding? And the answer is, the UN certainly hasn't been up to the task in any way, shape, or form. And so it's very easy for nations who find it inconvenient to walk away from such agreements that were negotiated in a more optimistic moment. And that, I think, is what we're seeing. That plus economic conditions and national security concerns, which are very real. The French, for example, are still quaking over the Charlie Hebdo episode, which well they might. That creates a concern about large numbers of newcomers, especially those of the Islamic faith, who are coming into France in ever larger numbers. Will the French open their doors to more refugees at this point? Not likely.
Well, you know, the French are notoriously racist as well, because that was what was the reaction in France. People were reacting also. While there were people who were saying France was under attack, people were very clear that it was when the Charlie Hebdo attack occurred, people were pretty clear that by then there had been this nationalistic fervor in France that was patently racist and directed toward people who were Muslims. Also, and the statistics are showing that the inflow of refugees is not likely statistically to create new frontiers for Islamic attacks or Islamic inspired attacks, because it's the other way around. The terrorists were usually European born, went to places like Iraq, went to places like Syria, and then came back. That's what the statistics are showing.
Well, I think you've got it coming both ways. I think there is a fear, whether or not it's a well-founded fear, it's a fear nevertheless on the part of those Western European nations that along with the refugees comes instability and the potential for a kind of cultural backlash against them. And there's the other factor that you mentioned, and that is that many of those who are activists with ISIS and other radical Islamic groups are dissatisfied with Europe, dissatisfied with their lives in Europe, feel that they have been sold a bill of goods and are going back to make the revolution. And so I think you've got it happening in both directions.
The United States, again, has been quite muted in its response to this refugee crisis. I mean, in terms of actually delivering something other than the 10,000 that the Obama administration has pledged to take. Is there something more that the U.S. can do?
Well, I think the private sector within the United States, the NGOs who specialize in immigration and refugee work, the many Jewish and Catholic and Protestant organizations that have traditionally extended their hands to refugees have to really step up to the plate and make the Obama administration know that they are ready to shoulder the responsibility of handling an increasing number of refugees. And then it becomes the Obama administration's job to take a humanitarian stand and also, I think, to try and cope with the problem where it is. And what that may mean military intervention, it may mean a more aggressive posture with respect to Assad's forces, it may mean a more aggressive posture with respect to ISIS, a different kind of pattern of bombing and so on. But the ultimate solution is to bring that part of the world back into order and to stop the forces that are creating the flow of refugees in the first place. And so far, the Obama administration has been a failure at that, a tremendous failure.
Angela Merkel of Germany has pledged to take 800,000 refugees and is having a hard time persuading European Union nations to do the same, to step up to the plate here. Do you believe that she will prevail, or do you believe that this particular issue will actually sink her?
I don't think it will sink her. I think right now Angela Merkel is probably the preeminent leader in Western Europe, and her voice carries moral weight, and it carries with it the weight of Germany's considerable economic resources and ability to coordinate a refugee program on its own soil. I think she's doing the very, very best she can to persuade her colleagues within the European Union to do their part. And so far she's met with some success, but limited success.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Professor Kraut, for joining us today and giving us your insights on this emerging problem and this crisis that just does not seem to want to go away anytime soon. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take a break and come back and talk about Bernie Sanders right after this break.
Waiting for the tide to flow. Sitting here in limbo, knowing that I have to go. resistance, but I know that my faith will lead me on. I can't say what life will show me, but I know what I've seen. I can't say where life will lead me, but I know where I've been. Tried my hand at love and friendship, but all that is past and gone. This little boy is moving on.
You're listening to PRN.FM, and you're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. I'm Utrice Lead. Bernie Sanders, the junior U.S. Senator from Vermont who is vying for the Democratic Party nomination in the 2016 presidential election, spoke yesterday at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia. Founded by the late Reverend Jerry Falwell, it is, with an enrollment of about 100,000 students, the largest private nonprofit university in the country and the largest Christian university in the world. Sanders began his speech jabbing other candidates, saying it's easy to talk to people with whom one agrees, but differences in opinions and beliefs on some issues should not obscure agreement on much larger issues that affect us all as a society, he said. As you know, there's much to disagree with Sanders' politics, but let's listen to what he had to say yesterday.
Let me take a moment, or a few moments, to tell you what motivates me in the work that I do as a public servant, as a senator from the state of Vermont. And let me tell you that it goes without saying I am far, far from being a perfect human being. But I am motivated by a vision which exists in all of the great religions, in Christianity, in Judaism, in Islam, in Buddhism, and other religions. And that vision is so beautifully and clearly stated in Matthew 7:12. And it states, "So in everything, do to others what you would have them do to you. For this sums up the law and the prophets." That is the golden rule. Do unto others what you would have them do to you. That is the golden rule, and it is not very complicated. Let me be frank, as I said a moment ago. I understand that the issues of abortion and gay marriage are issues that you feel very strongly about. We disagree on those issues. I get that. But let me respectfully suggest that there are other issues out there that are of enormous consequence to our country and, in fact, to the entire world. That maybe, just maybe, we do not disagree on. And maybe, just maybe, we can try to work together to resolve them. Amos 5:24. "But let justice roll on like a river, righteousness like a never-failing stream." Justice, treating others the way we want to be treated, treating all people, no matter their race, their color, their stature in life, with respect and with dignity. Now, here is my point. Some of you may agree with me, and some of you may not. But in my view, it would be hard for anyone in this room today to make the case that the United States of America, our great country, a country which all of us love, it would be hard to make the case that we are a just society or anything resembling a just society today. In the United States of America today, there is massive injustice in terms of income and wealth inequality. Injustice is rampant. We live, and I hope all of you know this, in the wealthiest country in the history of the world. But most Americans don't know that, because almost all of that wealth and income is going to the top 1%. Now that's the truth. We are living at a time, and I want all of you, if you would, put this in the context of the Bible, not me, in the context of the Bible. We are living at a time where a handful of people have wealth beyond comprehension. And I'm talking about tens of billions of dollars, enough to support their families for thousands of years, with huge yachts and jet planes and tens of billions, more money than they would ever know what to do with. But at that very same moment, there are millions of people in our country, let alone the rest of the world, who are struggling to feed their families. They are struggling to put a roof over their heads, and some of them are sleeping out on the streets. They are struggling to find money in order to go to a doctor when they are sick. Now, when we talk about morality and when we talk about justice, we have to, in my view, understand that there is no justice when so few have so much and so many have so little. There is no justice, and I want you to hear this clearly, when the top one-tenth of 1%, not 1%, the top one-tenth of 1%, today in America owns almost as much wealth as the bottom 90%. And in your hearts, you will have to determine the morality of that and the justice of that. In my view, there is no justice when here in Virginia and Vermont and all over this country, millions of people are working long hours for abysmally low wages of $7.25 an hour, of $8 an hour, of $9 an hour. Working hard, but unable to bring in enough money to adequately feed their kids. And yet, at that same time, 58% of all new income generated is going to the top 1%. You have got to think about the morality of that, the justice of that, and whether or not that is what we want to see in our country. In my view, there is no justice when, in recent years, we have seen a proliferation of millionaires and billionaires, while at the same time, the United States of America has the highest rate of childhood poverty of any major country on earth? How can we, I want you to go into your hearts, how can we talk about morality, about justice, when we turn our backs on the children of our country? Now, you have got to think about it. You have to think about it, and you have to feel it in your guts. Are you content? Do you think it's moral that 20% of the children in this country, the wealthiest country in the history of the world, are living in poverty? Do you think it is acceptable that 40% of African American children are living in poverty? In my view, there is no justice, and morality suffers when in our wealthy country, millions of children go to bed hungry. That is not morality. And that, in my view, is not what America should be about. In my view, there is no justice when the 15 wealthiest people in this country in the last 2 years, saw their wealth increased by $170 billion. 2 years. Wealthiest 15 people in this country saw their wealth increase by $170 billion. My friends, that is more wealth acquired in a 2 year period than is owned by the bottom 130 million Americans. And while the very, very rich become much richer, millions of families have no savings at all, nothing in the bank. And they worry every single day that if their car breaks down, they can't get to work. And if they can't get to work, they lose their jobs. And if they lose their jobs, they don't feed their families. In the last 2 years, 15 people saw a $170 billion increase in their wealth. 45 million Americans live in poverty. That, in my view, is not justice. That is a rigged economy designed by the wealthiest people in this country to benefit the wealthiest people in this country at the expense of everybody else. In my view, there is no justice when thousands of Americans die every single year because they don't have any health insurance and don't go to a doctor when they should. I have talked personally to doctors throughout Vermont and physicians all over this country. And without exception, they tell me that there are times when patients walk into their office very, very sick. And they say, why didn't you come in here when you were sick? And the answer is, I don't have any health insurance, or I have a high deductible. I thought the problem would get better. And sometimes it doesn't, and sometimes they die because they lack health insurance. That is not justice. That is not morality. People should not be dying in the United States of America when they are sick. What that is an indication that we are the only major country on earth that does not guarantee health care to all people as a right. And I think we should change that. And I think that when we talk about morality, what we are talking about is all of God's children, the poor, the wretched. They have a right to go to a doctor when they are sick. You know, there is a lot of talk in this country from politicians about family values. You've all heard that. Well, let me tell you about a family value. In my view, there is no justice when low-income and working-class mothers are forced to separate from their babies 1 or 2 weeks after birth and go back to work because they need the money that their jobs provide. Now, I know everybody here, we all are, maybe in different ways, but all of us believe in family values. Jane and I have 4 kids. We have 7 beautiful grandchildren. We believe in family values. But it is not a family value when all of you know that the most important moments and time of a human being's life is the first weeks and months after that baby is born. That is the moment when mother bonds with the baby, gets to love and know her baby, and dad is there as well. That is what a family is about. And those of you, or at least those of you who are parents, more parents back here than there, I suspect, you know what an unforgettable moment that is, what an important moment that is. And I want you to think whether you believe it is a family value that the United States of America is the only major country on earth that does not provide paid family and medical leave. Now, in English, what that means is that all over the world, when a woman has her baby, she is guaranteed the right, because society understands how important that moment is. She is guaranteed the right to stay home and get income in order to nurture her baby. And that is why I believe, when we talk about family values, that the United States government must provide at least 12 weeks of paid family and medical leave. In my view, there is no justice in our country when youth unemployment exists at tragically high levels. I requested a study last month from a group of economists, and what they told me is that 51% of African American high school graduates between the ages of 17 and 20 are unemployed or underemployed. 51%. We have in this country sufficient amounts of money to put more people in jail than any other country on earth. The United States has more people in jail than China, a communist authoritarian country. But apparently, we do not have enough money to provide jobs and education to our young people. I believe that's wrong. I am not a theologian. I am not an expert on the Bible, nor am I a Catholic. I am just a United States Senator from the small state of Vermont. But I agree with Pope Francis, who will soon be coming to visit us in the United States. I agree with Pope Francis when he says, and I quote, "The current financial crisis originated in a profound human crisis, the denial of the primacy of the human person." And this is what he writes. "We have created new idols. The worship of the ancient golden calf has returned in a new and ruthless guise, in the idolatry of money and the dictatorship of an impersonal economy lacking a truly human purpose." End of quote. And the Pope also writes, quote, "There is a need for financial reform along ethical lines that would produce in its turn an economic reform to benefit everyone. Money has to serve, not to rule." End of quote. Now, those are pretty profound words, which I hope we will all think about. In the Pope's view, and I agree with him, we are living in a nation and in a world, and the Bible speaks to this issue, in a nation and in a world which worships not love of brothers and sisters, not love of the poor and the sick, but worships the acquisition of money and great wealth. I do not believe that is the country we should be living in. Money and wealth should serve the people. The people should not have to serve money and wealth. Throughout human history, there has been endless discussion. It is part of who we are as human beings, people who think and ask questions. Endless discussion and debate about the meaning of justice and about the meaning of morality. And I know that here at Liberty University, those are the kinds of discussions you have every day, and those are the kinds of discussions you should be having, and the kind of discussions we should be having all over America. I would hope, and I conclude with this thought, I would hope very much that as part of that discussion and part of that learning process, some of you will conclude that if we are honest in striving to be a moral and just society, it is imperative that we have the courage to stand with the poor, to stand with working people, and when necessary, take on very powerful and wealthy people whose greed, in my view, is doing this country enormous harm. Thank you all very much.
That was Bernice Sanders wowing them at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia, yesterday, speaking to a packed auditorium. the university founded by the late Jerry Falwell, with an enrollment of about 100,000 students, is the largest Christian university in the world. Well, of course, interesting what he had to say, and I'm sure that would be part of the fodder for discussion on Free Your Mind Friday. But it was important to hear Bernie Sanders and his interpretation of where America ought to be and where he is, and forging a relationship with a constituency that was not expected. You know, here he is talking to a very, very religious outfit. He's not known as a person who touts his own religiosity, but it was an interesting thing that he should appear there yesterday and frame the discussion the way he did. Let me know what you're thinking. Let me know how this program resonated with you today. You can write me at leadstories@gmail.com. Stay tuned. Keep it right here at prn.fm. Coming up next, The Infectious Myth with David Crowe. You can always reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. And I hope this program gave you something to think about today. Of course, a pleasure and a great privilege, as always, to be in your company. And let's meet again here tomorrow. A very important conversation to be had tomorrow as well. Bye-bye. But I know we won't belong now. I know we won't belong.